February 4th, 1982. We're talking about the bibliophile in Pittsburgh.
Right. Pittsburgh, as I said, they're made up mainly of local people. Lois knows them, and she's a member herself, and I think that we would both agree quite interesting people, numbering among them authors, printers, binders, calligraphers, illustrators, and many, many librarians, and just those people who are interested in books. We also have a very large non-resident group, which includes some of the outstanding people in the country, I would say, who are also in the book world. Well, being with these people has just been a new type of education. They have taught Helene and myself many things, and we have had great experiences with them. I guess one of our foremost members was Cardinal Wright, and in 1976, 42 of us made a trip to Italy, actually through the auspices of his good office. We spent 3 weeks in Italy and really were able to see and to be admitted to places that would never have been possible without him. And it was one of those rare occasions that all of us cherish very much. I might say that being with this group is also, we have been able to meet other people. And I have gotten to know a few descendants of Thomas Jefferson. Jane Whitehill is a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson through the Coolidge family in Boston. And we and her late husband Walter were the best of friends. Walter was a great scholar, probably the finest scholar I've ever known. He was the director of the Athenaeum, which is a private library, or I should say a private corporate library in Boston, but well known. I think it's one of the oldest libraries in the country. And he was a prolific writer. And unfortunately, he died a few years ago, but during those few years, we became very good friends, carried on quite a prolific correspondence. And it was one of those rare things that I got to know a man of this stature.
So the bibliophiles really motivated you to become a Jeffersonian scholar.
Well,
given talks on Jefferson.
Well, I think.
Right the other way.
Lois, I think you're no, I don't think you're wrong in what you say, but I don't think I'm a Jefferson scholar. I would be admit to being a Jefferson student. I don't think that I'm
a
scholar. Yes, and right, and I think that.
Have you published anything about Jefferson?
Well, I've only published a short part of him, which I wrote in a medical journal, and the title of my topic was "The Etiology of a Bibliophile," which just means, how did it originate, or your origin of the bibliophile? Etiology is a word commonly used in medicine. And I've spoken on him as in his relationship to science, and also as far as the bibliophiles are concerned, about his involvement in great libraries.
So many of our basic principles in America have been founded upon the principles of Jeffersonian democracy. Can you give us more insight into what you really think was the greatness of the man and how he was able to transmit this?
Well, every time you think you got a hold of Jefferson, he eludes you, because he was so involved and so productive in so many fields and disciplines. He had a great feeling, I think, of, he himself was a student of history, let me say that, and had a great feel for it, and I think he was conscious of this his entire life. He had a rare attribute of understanding the common man, and had great faith in the common man. I think that is the difference between him and any other of the world leaders that probably preceded him or have proceeded him. He was against a class system. He believed that everybody could do his thing. An example of this is in the Order of Cincinnatus, which was a kind of an elite group of army and military officers that was formed after the war. And these people were of which Washington was a member, by the way. And these people were more or less, you know, the ones who were going to do the thinking and probably handle the affairs, or when they saw fit to step in to handle the affairs of the country. Jefferson was deadly against this. He was against setting up any elite. He, in fact, used his influence to have Washington resign from the group, and actually, really, the group kind of came to a demise. Hamilton was one of the members. He felt that you should put the trust in people, and that the basis of people doing, I guess, the more nearly correct thing was proper education. And he believed that you should educate everyone. That, in fact, he was one of the first proponents of public education, which passed the legislature in Virginia many years after he had proposed it, but which he continually fought for. I think that, and Jefferson believed everyone should have a vote. And there's no question about what influence he had upon us, and I think that his Declaration of Independence is probably the foundation, the keystone of our whole system. I could go on and on.
Well, that's very interesting, and I really think that your insight is important. You mentioned that he was for the common man, and certainly we know that, and he was revolutionary for his time, and yet we also know that he was an elitist, and he was a slave owner, and some people feel that the two don't seem to go together.
Well, I think that's, I think that he probably struggled with that himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was well aware of this problem. There's no question about that he was born to the land of gentry, but actually he kind of revolted against this. He might have been the first of the so-called children's revolution. He refused to dress up and wear a wig when he became president. He it was common for the presidents that preceded him, Adams and Washington, to have levees where people were invited to kind of afternoon teas or parties. He never would do this. He if they came, he was dressed in his riding habit or something of that effect. So he really did do what he could to destroy any class system in the country. I think that the slavery issue is another issue. There's no question Jefferson wanted to abolish slavery. This was deleted from the Declaration of Independence. And he kind of, it was an economic situation with him. There was no way he could do without his slaves as far as he was going to survive. I mean, Jefferson died bankrupt, and he was impoverished. And I think that this was something that he kind of worked out himself. But there's no question it would be much better for history if he had freed his slaves, all his slaves.
Are there any lessons that you think we should have learned better from him, or that you would like to see?
Oh, well, there's no question.
Revive
that,
now?
I always say if you don't know history, you're sure bound to repeat it. And I'm afraid that our recent presidents have not been any tower of knowledge or intelligence, and their actions certainly speak for themselves. Jefferson said that there is nothing like a free government and a free press, but if you had a choice of only having one, take the free press. And I think that that's rather profound. And what he's really telling us is that free people can't exist without a free press.
Mm-hmm. And that might be one of the most
important
lessons.
Yes, I think so. Yes, I think
so.
Yeah, I think
decade.
That Nixon kind of taught us about that, and I think we see more and more. I think people are very critical of the press, which we should be. But on the other hand, it's our first line of defense, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He belonged to another scholarly group called the Junta. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's kind of a fun thing, of which Charlie Weaver is also a member.
This is the Junta.
This is the Pittsburgh Junta, and we spell it J-U-N-T-A. Just so happens that just 2 weeks ago, we celebrated our 100th anniversary. The group was founded in 1882 by a group of men, I presume, who lived in the East End of Pittsburgh. And, of course, if we think of the East End of Pittsburgh, that was where the money people lived. And they got together as more or less a discussion group to discuss events of the day. And the group went on for about 20-some-odd years before they discovered that they were much like Benjamin Franklin's Junto, spelled J-U-N-T-O. And if we look back and see what Franklin did, he organized this group of men in Philadelphia whom he sort of hand-picked that were to talk about philosophical matters and meet for conviviality and things of that sort. They met in they wore their Mason aprons. That was the sign of the Junta, or the dress that Franklin had. But the Pittsburgh Junta has always met in black tie, and we meet about we have 10 meetings a year, meet every 3 weeks, one of which is an annual banquet, which we just held, which was to coincide with Franklin's birthday. It's always in early January, Franklin's birthday being the 17th or the 19th of January. It just eludes me which date is correct. And for years, this has been a, I guess, the last of the world's male chauvinistic groups. So we've never had women at a meeting, and it was stated that in 1919, it was suggested to the banquet committee that they might invite the women to the annual banquet, and the banquet committee never met again that year. So it was one of the few years that a banquet was not held. But we did break precedent this year, and we felt that at least once every 100 years this could be done. So our wives and friends accompanied us to this banquet, which we just held at the Pittsburgh Golf Club. There's a program that is arranged a year ahead, and we usually have two speakers at a meeting discussing what the program committee thought would be a pertinent topic, and usually the talks are point and counterpoint. Following the talk, there is a 2 or 3 minute discussion by each member who's present on the topic, and then we sit and enjoy some light food and drinks. It's made up of a group of people who are rather very interesting. It is not to exceed 35 members, and we do have a few honorary members, I think about 3 or 4, who live within our area here or have moved from town. But it's a very active group. Yes, it's a very active group, and everybody I think looks forward to going to the meeting and taking part in the participating in the conversation.
And you've been president of both of these groups.
Well, this year I was very lucky to be president of the Junta during its 100th anniversary, and the Pittsburgh Bibliophiles, I was president when we made our trip to Italy. So I've kind of been involved in them very much, and continue to.
Doesn't the Junta meet in other cities as well?
No, this is just a local group, and I think we have now survived longer than Franklin's own Junta. I don't think his Junta survived 100 years. So we're kind of proud of this group. Many of our friends, I guess, who are bibliophiles are also members of this group.
Mm-hmm. You've also paralleled these very interesting hobbies with a very interesting career through your profession. Perhaps we can jump back a little bit to the beginning of your college days and medical school days. You told us that you graduated in 1941.
No.
From high school?
That's right, from high school, right.
And then went to Duke University.
Right.
Which seems a little odd for a somebody with limited means from Pittsburgh, McKeesport, Pennsylvania, to go to North Carolina. Do you want to tell us how that happened?
No, I think that I think some people are lucky, and I think I've been very lucky. Sometimes, well, you may not even have any control over what events take, but in the main, they've been very good to me. You're right, that was a big move. And if we all recall our own youth and our parents, we were sort of provincial in our thought because the world really moved around where we were. In fact, just an aside, I can remember as a very young child, and this was preschool years, and I don't remember if it was Armistice Day or Memorial Day, and we lived on Jenny Lind Street, and there was a troop of soldiers who were veterans of the war moving, marching down the street to go to fall in line in a parade, and I really thought that this was the whole army that represented the United States in World War I, and I couldn't understand that there was something beyond our boundaries of our city that was also involved, so that gives you kind of an idea about how small the world really is in those days. Yes, I was expected to go to, my mother wanted me to go to Pitt. In fact, I was a member of the debate team. Lois had been a member the year before me, and we were lucky enough to win the state debate championship at McKeesport. So there was an automatic scholarship that went with that to University of Pittsburgh. And of course, my parents felt that I should have received it. Fortunately, a person received it who needed it and who really has made a name for herself today. But beside that, I did apply at Pitt, and I was that was one of the schools where I was considering going. I wasn't too happy about that, and my dad, as I told you, was a salesman who traveled, and he said to me, you know, maybe you ought to think about going to Allegheny College. That's not too far away, and maybe you would enjoy that. And then my uncle, who was a physician, said to me, well, if you're going to go 50 miles from home, you might as well go 500 miles from home. And he said, you know, Duke University, they're down there in Durham, North Carolina, and they have a very good medical school. And at the time, the only thing we knew about Duke was that they beat Pitt on the football field in a snowstorm in Durham one year, which really knocked Pitt out of the Rose Bowl and Duke into it. Well, it so happens I applied at Duke and was accepted, and that's where I went. And that's really what took me down there. Mm-hmm. And as I said to you, that I went... since the war broke out in December of 41, I continued to go through school, you know, went through summer schools and went the year round. At the conclusion of my undergraduate work down there, my mother again said to me, well, I think you've been away from home long enough, and now you should go to Pitt Medical School. Well, in those days, the Jewish candidates were selected by Leslie Falk, Jr. That was just a foregone conclusion. Of course, you had to have certain standards to get on his list, and then the six or seven who were so selected were really he had great influence on. And the idea was that you had to get to him to be able to become a candidate. So I was introduced to one of the Jewish men in town here who was high in the hierarchy, and when I went to see him, he said to me, do you make straight A's? I said, no, I don't make straight A's. He said, well, maybe you ought to make straight A's and come back and see me next year. I said, I think that's good. So I left and I went to my mother and I said to her, I don't think I'm going to Pitt. And I applied for Duke Medical School.
Excuse me, please, wait. Yeah. I'd like to go into this. The system with Leslie Falk a little first. What you really were referring to then was a quota system that
yes.
The University of Pittsburgh
had,
right?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
This was about 1945.
I started medical school in January of 44, so it was 43.
Okay, so that there were only permitted, first of all, in Pitt Medical School at that time, six or seven Jews.
That's right. There was 10% of the class. You know,
uh-huh.
So I don't know. I think they may have to divide a guy up because they maybe took 65 people or something like that,
uh-huh.
Or 70. But
okay. And Leslie Falk Jr.
was
from the Falk family?
Yes. He's Mr. Falk today. I don't know if his father was involved in that or not. I'm pretty sure it was he.
Was this Leon Falk's brother?
I'm sorry, it is Leon.
Leon Falk.
I'm giving that wrong.
Leon Falk.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
yeah. I'm sorry. I correct that. Yeah.
Philanthropist.
Okay. Right. Leon Falk. Yeah. He really had the influence on that. And and the interesting thing is, which I mean, there's a lot of we get off on many tangents here. Is the person who made the entree for me to go to see the first person. Was Sam Wise, who at that time was Congressman of the U.S. House of Representatives, and Sammy, who was a very good friend and a staunch supporter of mine, made the effort for me to have this initial conversation. The person
Sammy Wise was from Duquesne, Pennsylvania?
No, he was from Glassport.
Okay, who he later became a judge?
That's right. From Congressman, he became a judge, and I knew Sam through my AZA days, and we were good friends. In fact, I was a big gun in Washington because when people went up there, I sent them to his office to get passes so they could go to Congress or things like that.
He was a remarkable person in trying to help everybody.
Yes,
everybody
he was.
Within the
yes, he was.
Larger
yes.
community
right.
really
and
put himself out.
He was a good friend. Yeah.
Yes.
And I so I just to get back to Duke, to give you the contrast, I applied to medical school. I had an interview on Monday. I had my acceptance on Friday. And they knew me than the man in the moon. So it did. Yeah.
But they knew your record.
Well, right. But I mean, I was not any personal contact. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, how do you account for that?
Well, I just hope that they thought they were accepting a good candidate. I don't know. But although we weren't overrun with Jews in the class, I mean, we only had I think there were about five of us in the school in my class. And what is interesting is our dean. Who was a good rock rib Southern Presbyterian. His wife, his daughter married a Jew, and she was a classmate of mine, so we felt we got about like five and a half.
Did the quota system exist in every medical school in the United States?
I think there was kind of an unwritten, it was kind of an unwritten law, I think. There's no question that the there was a small percentage in all schools.
Did you experience any anti-Semitism or...
At Duke?
Yes.
No, I can't say I did. I think that the South is different than the North, and not that, and there are that many Jews, but it's there were very few issues that were it came down to racial situations and things of that sort. And many things were accepted. You know, in those days, it was just like we had two hospitals on this camp at the university. It was one hospital, but what I'm saying to you is. Whites were in one portion and blacks were admitted to the other, and that's how it went. And no one ever thought of questioning that, you know. And also in our clinics, there were the clinics for the whites and the clinics for the blacks.
And that lasted until what year?
It lasted until 1954, I guess, or whenever the, or the 60s. When was it that the decision was handed down in 54, I guess the...
Brown versus...
I think that the great... transformation took part, a revolution took place in the early 60s. Now today you go back to the school and you would never have known that this existed. They
we're talking about Duke University.
Duke, yeah. I mean, or in the South. I mean, there's everyone moves among one another, no matter what your color is. The interesting thing is, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, is that they recently built a new hospital at Duke, which is quite a establishment, and I've taken some people down there to see it from this area. Some trustees and also some people who are in the health field. The hospital consists of private rooms or what they call single bedrooms throughout the entire hospital. There are no double bedrooms or more than that. I mean, no semi-privates or things like that as we know. And I asked them what was that influenced them. Was this a factor? And they said absolutely not. They denied this altogether. In fact, there was nothing that they claimed they never thought about it. But they feel that this is the best way they could deliver medical care. And, of course, the movement now is towards more of private care rooms and things of that sort. I mean, that's what everyone's getting back to now in the hospital field. But this whole institution is that built like that, and I thought that. I couldn't help but think that, but they claimed it wasn't.
Okay, do you want to describe your medical school days?
Well, I think that... unfortunately, the war was on. I was in the Navy what they call the Navy B-12. And, again, lucky that I was able to stay and pursue what I wanted to do. I always look back with a great deal of pleasure on my medical school days because I was exposed to what I thought was some fine teachers, some men who were, besides being fine physicians, were noble gentlemen and people with great intellects. And they taught me a lot. It's funny that when you're in medical school, you're very close with your classmates because you're working with each other any time of day or night in a very close atmosphere. It's strange now that as I look back upon it, these people were very distant because they haven't been in my life since then. But this November, my class will be celebrating its 35th. graduation, and I am now in correspondence with some people, and I think we're going to have a big turnout for that, so that'll be fun to go back to. I have been active at Duke, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been involved at Duke, although I have some people who I were personally attached to when I was there as a student, rarely are they any of this group now that I'm active with. Mm-hmm.
In what way have you been involved at Duke?
Well, I was a member of in the mid-60s, of a committee that was called had some great name attached to it, something like the Executive Committee for the Development of the Medical Center. And through it, I became very friendly with who was then the president of Duke University, Douglas Knight. Doug Knight was the president at Lawrence. After Pusey was named president of Harvard, he succeeded Pusey at Lawrence in Wisconsin, and then he became president of Duke. But for some reason or other, we became great friends, and unfortunately, Doug Knight became a casualty of the revolution of the universities in the late 60s, and due to situations down there which were intolerable and which I think every campus experienced, he became a casualty and had to resign his presidency. To this day, we are very good friends, see each other. I'm also a member of the Grolier Club in New York, which is the bibliophile group in New York, and this is the oldest bibliophile group in the country and I guess kind of the most limited. And Doug just became a member of that, so we'll be able to enjoy that group together. And he and I have maintained our friendship since then. There was also a...
How do you get to be a member of the Grolier Group?
How do you get to be a member? Well, the one who really was responsible for me becoming a member was George Lawrence, whom I spoke to you about, who was the director of the Hunt Botanical here. And George in himself was a great scholar. He was a botanist, prolific writer, was very influential in bringing the Linnaeus collection to Pittsburgh. Linnaeus was a botanist in the early 1700s who classified botany as a Swede who did that. And of course, anything that's written before him is historical, and anything written since that has substance to it. I guess he was to botany what Darwin was to evolution. When Roy Hunt died, I guess R.K. Mellon asked George Lawrence what he could do to create a memorial for Roy Hunt. George Lawrence, I guess, had his eye on this Linnaeus collection for a long time and knew the Linnaeus family in Sweden and was able to obtain this collection for the Pittsburgh Hunt Botanical. Well, anyhow, he and I were friendly, and when we were touring Italy together, which was in 76, he said to me one day, "How would you like to be a member of the Grolier Club?" Said, "Well, that was beyond my furthest thoughts. I never thought I could be a member of the Grolier Club." Well, he did propose me,